This is Lawrence Tuning, and these are my 88 friends.
Me and my 88 friends. Me and my 88 friends. I will sing you a song that will help me along. They're my one-man band. I'm the number one fan.
Welcome to episode 154 of our show, Me and My 88 Friends. The song you just heard was a song I wrote in the early 1970s called Jesus, You've Been So Real. We have rounded a corner in the last week. We completed our third year of this show. It's hard to believe. We're moving into the fourth year as of tonight. And it's been a wonderful blessing to me to be able to come to you from week to week. If you're new to this show, Let me just tell you three things. One is, I am a songwriter, and I love to sing my songs to you. These are songs that have been written over a 54-year period of time. I write from the piano, which has 88 keys, so hence the name, Me and My 88 Friends. The second thing I want to tell you is I love to talk about how good Jesus is. I have a relationship with him. It's not a stained glass kind of a deal. He is a living person. He arose from the tomb. And I love to talk about the peace that he can bring into all of our lives. And the third thing is, I love to hear people's stories of how they came to faith and how God has led their lives. So those three components pretty much make up our show. Now, I was thinking of something else as I was riding over here in the car. A lot of our guests on the show come from the Bible Belt, and most people in the Bible Belt know what we mean when we say, I got saved, or I was saved. We also have another term called, I was under conviction before I got saved. So in case you're from another part of the country and you don't have a clue what we're talking about, let me just say this. When people say, I was saved, that comes straight from the angel Gabriel who spoke to the Virgin Mary and said, I want you to name him Jesus because he will save his people from their sins. So when you say, I was saved, that just means I had an experience with Christ where I knew that he had forgiven me of my sins and he gave me the assurance and that peace that I was right with God and that I could live forever. There's many times a moment where you suddenly realize that has happened. When you say I'm under conviction, that refers to that feeling of uncomfortableness before you make that decision to turn to Christ, where you sort of know you ought to do it, but you sort of resist, but that feeling is just stronger and stronger, and you finally give up and say, okay, Lord, you are the only answer for me. Put another way, Jesus said in Revelation, I stand at the door and I knock. If anyone will hear me and will open the door, I will come in and dine with him. Or I will fellowship with him. That's the whole process right there. You hear a knock and you have to decide if you're going to make that decision to open that door or not. But it's a decision that you make. When you make it, Jesus becomes real and he comes into your life. That happens through prayer. Put still another way, I wrote a song about that verse, and it's called I Heard a Knock.
some bread and something to drink. And he said, I stand at the door and I knock. If you'll hear me, I'd open up. I will come in and I'll dine with you. Oh, I'm glad he kept right on, wouldn't leave me alone. He kept right on, wouldn't leave me alone. Until I opened up, I opened up. I'm glad I opened up, I opened up. It's been a beautiful life since I opened up, opened up. And now he's in, he's no longer knocking, knocking at my door.
We always record this podcast at the home of Brian Hoogenboom, who is our engineer par excellence. He's also a wonderful guitar player, singer, songwriter. And so I'm sitting here with Brian, as I do every week. And Brian, you know, last night we celebrated, or I didn't celebrate it, but many people observed what we call Halloween. Do you know what? I was sitting at my table last night, and the first doorbell that rang, you know, I have bad knees. Do you understand I have bad knees? So it took me a while to get to the door. I opened the door. This little smart aleck kid, about 6 years old, says, hey, how come it took you so long to get to the door and open the door? I said, because I'm old. I wanted to say something else, but I didn't. Anyway, other than Halloween, much of the Christian world celebrates it as Reformation Day. And that's the day when Martin Luther revolutionized the world, when he nailed 95 theses on the door of a Wittenberg church, or was it a castle?
Well, I just looked it up, and it's actually, the answer to that question is yes.
Explain.
It's Wittenberg Castle Church.
Don't you like an answer when both sides are right? Anyway, his big thing was he learned through the Spirit of God that the just shall live by faith, that it's not works that saves anybody. It's simple faith in Christ. Little trivia here that many people don't know. I read an exhaustive biography of Martin Luther. He got that revolutionary revelation sitting on the toilet. Now, that's true. He wrote later where he was in the castle. I think it was called the Tower. It was some particular name. And that was where the loo was, or the toilet was. So he changed the world. God spoke to him while he was on a toilet. I just think that's kind of funny in a way.
That's outstanding.
No, he was sitting. Oh, Lord, help us, God. Now, I'm going to name this episode Back to the Source of the River, Part 1. I was in Virginia many years ago, and I heard this pastor talk about an experience he had as a child when they used to play in the woods. There was a creek or a river, and they wanted to know, where did that river start? So they went through the woods and walked and walked and walked till they found the spring where it actually began. I was thinking about this lately. And I wanted to do a couple of episodes, which we're going to do one of them tonight and do the next one next week. I want to take a journey back to my spiritual roots and where it all began for me, where I had that revelation that the just could live by faith. And I was, as we say, saved. It was a little country church on the top of a hill in Lee County, South Carolina. Everything started from there. My family went there. I've got cousins, uncles, aunts that went there. My great-grandfather actually was the first pastor. And when I was 8 years old, everything changed in my life, and I never looked back. It is called the St. Andrew Church of God in Lee County, South Carolina. So on this episode, I want to interview the current pastor of that wonderful church. Next week, I'm going to go way, way back to my childhood and interview the son of the pastor that I first knew. But we're going to interview a great man named Scott Hodge, and he's going to tell his story. But before we do that, I want to sing a song I wrote when I started thinking about that night when Jesus came into my life in that little country church. It's called "The Night That Changed My Life." No, I never wrote down the day, but I can take you to the spot where the Lord reached down from heaven and He came into my heart. I believe it was early summer. I was still a child when I heard Jesus call me, and I walked down the aisle. My mother knelt beside me. I remember it to this day. She put her arm around me, and she began to pray. Then my tears started falling, for I was praying too. Then she asked, "Do you feel better now?" And I smiled and I said, "I do." Changed my life. On October 6, 2023, I sat down with Pastor Scott Hodge, who was the pastor of the church where I came to know the Lord, St. Andrew Church of God in Lee County, South Carolina. Let's go to that conversation. I'm sitting in the offices of the church where I found Jesus, where I accepted Christ. 8 years old, I accepted Christ, and I never looked back. So I'm talking to Scott Hodge, who is the present pastor. Scott gave me a list of the different people who have pastored this church, beginning with my great-grandfather. He served from 1902 to 1910. Then he came back in 1925 and pastored here till 1940. You would be the 21st pastor, because two of them came back twice. Yeah. 21st pastor of this church, which was started in 1902. Is that right?
That sounds right, yeah.
Yeah.
We did this list to do a consultation with some leadership within the Church of God to figure out where we were and all that, but yeah.
So, good afternoon, Scott. It's good to see you again.
Good to see you, Lawrence. Great. Thanks for coming.
You've done a great job here. You've been a pastor here for 5 years, we said earlier.
Almost to the day. 2 days, it'll be 5 years exactly.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. So, how long have you been a pastor?
I'm 59, but I came late, and I was 35, so whatever that is. What's that, 24 years, give or take?
Okay.
I don't like to do math in public, but that's the best I could do. Somewhere around, not quite 25 years, coming up on 25 years maybe, but I was a late bloomer.
So, I didn't know this about you. So, yeah, you were a late bloomer. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Let's start with your life, and then we'll talk about this church.
I was an Army brat, so I was born in Germany, and came back to the States when I was 18 months old, and my dad retired from the Army when I was 13, and then we moved back to West Virginia after that. And you know, while we were in the Army, we lived in Alaska and Oklahoma and Alabama and, of course, Germany for a while. Dad, when he retired in 1977, we moved the family back to the roots of the family in West Virginia, coal mining country. And actually, we moved back to agriculture country, but close to about an hour and a half away from the coal mining country that they all grew up in. My parents are both from Cabin Creek, West Virginia.
Cabin Creek. Mm-hmm. Wow, that sounds like coal country.
You ever hear Zeke from Cabin Creek?
No.
Jerry West.
Oh.
Yeah, the great basketball player. He's from East Bank High School. Right? That was the school. In fact, my dad played on the basketball team with Jerry West when he was young. So.
Your dad played with Jerry West?
Yeah, he did. He said he probably wouldn't remember him, but you know how that goes. But
so were your grandparents and all coal miners?
Both of them were. My grandfather on my dad's side got out of it probably just before I was born, and I don't think he was in it very long. My other grandfather on my mom's side, I have vivid memories of him coming home and just being covered in coal dust head to toe and just white around his eyes where he wore his goggles. And back in those days, they had respirators. I remember seeing his respirator that you're supposed to wear. It was clean as a whistle. They never wore them. And of course, when he died with black lung and emphysema and all that kind of stuff. It was a tough life, very tough life. But my grandfather on my dad's side, he got out of that a lot younger and did carpentry. He was a finished carpenter.
So I'm interested about this coal mining deal.
Yeah.
Did they live in a coal mining town and the little cabins that the companies built? And was there a company store they used to?
Everything you just said, yeah. Until my grandfather retired, they never owned their own house. And in fact, I remember we lived in Cabin Creek on and off when Dad went to Korea. Dad was in Vietnam. And of course, during those times, we'd move back home. And be around my mom's family. And I remember two houses my grandparents lived in that were company houses. Uh-huh. And in fact, it's very much like military life, because I remember when we were young and in the military, Dad was in the military, we'd have to move out of our house because they needed to put in air conditioning or they needed to paint all the post housing. So we'd move, two, three doors down the road. That was the same. They were repainting and freshening up all the company houses up in Cabin Creek and in a little town along the creek there called Carbon, West Virginia. And they moved right next door so that they could paint that house and then move somebody else in it. But that was their life. And they If you hear that old song, 16 Tons.
Oh, yeah. I'm thinking about playing a little clip of it on this.
That and Coal Miner's Daughter were were anthems to my family. But it was exactly that. They had company script, which was their money. They lived in company housing. The stores were all company stores.
Yeah.
And you never went outside of that community, you know, for a long time. I mean, eventually they did, but especially in the earlier days when transportation wasn't as, you know, slick as it is nowadays. I mean, we drive 45 minutes, we think nothing of it. But from where they were on Cabin Creek to Charleston, which is the capital, I mean, it took a good hour, hour and a half to come out of that creek. And it really is not that far.
You load 16 tons, what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
You're listening to our podcast called Me and My 88 Friends. This is Lawrence Tuning, your host. On this episode, I'm interviewing Pastor Scott Hodge, who is the current pastor of the church where I came to the Lord as an eight-year-old kid. Scott was raised an Army brat, and he got used to moving from place to place throughout his life. So let's pick up the conversation where Scott and I were talking about what he called the nomad life. You were born outside of West Virginia?
In Germany.
And yeah. You're born in Germany?
Born in Germany, yeah. But just and left there when I was 18 months old. Now, I went in the military myself when I grew up, and Susan and I, my wife, lived in Germany for 3 years during that time. In fact, I was a German linguist for the military. Don't ask me to speak it because it's been too long, but that's what I did for the military way back.
Some people thrive moving around. Other kids, it makes them an introvert. Was it hard to all of a sudden, okay, we're going to move to another town, another school?
You know, it's kind of like that question we ask, how do kids grow up in war-torn countries? And when that's all you know, that's all you know. And that was us. We, you know, I once Dad retired, he started working for, he was a nursing home administrator, worked for large corporations that moved him around. We still moved around. I moved 2 weeks before my senior year of high school. We moved and, you know, changed schools. But I did first and second grade in Alaska. I did part of third grade back in West Virginia, the other part in Alabama. And by the time I was, that's where Dad, we were in Alabama when Dad retired, and then came up to West Virginia to do junior high and high school. But 2 weeks before my senior year, moved to another town, and Dad was opening up another nursing home for that big company. So, yeah, and I told my mom recently, because it's tough because my parents are alone now up there. We've got one niece that lives in town. Myself and my brothers and sister were kind of all spread out, and I was teasing Mom. I said, "It's your fault we're not around. You just taught us how to move, and you taught us to be nomads." And you know, ministry's kind of like that too. Although I don't like to move a lot, this is only my second senior pastorate, and I was at my first one for 13 years, and I feel like long-term pastor is the only way to really affect any change.
Yeah.
If you're allowed, and you know, if you're allowed to stay, then
that's right.
I like to stay. So,
hey, I talked to a pastor of this church.
Yeah.
Now, I grew up in this church, so I know all the people here. So I'm being very careful now. But this one pastor, he was here just a few years, and very nice guy. He said, "You know, I learned a important lesson in life. When you pastor a rural church where the same people have been here for years, and you think you're going to come in and just automatically revolutionize everything and have a lot of changes," says, "their philosophy is, we'll be here long after you've gotten the Mayflower Band moved away." So,
and that's true. I think as pastors, we have to remember that sometimes we move on. I mean, that's not, you know, I don't think any pastor goes into a church hoping to move on soon, but we have to remember that, you know, this is, I mean, we know it's God's church. So just know that up front. But what I'm saying is these folks will be here when we're gone. And so, you know, that's why affecting change is a long term.
It sure is.
You really can't. I mean, I've been here 5 years, and 2 years of that was COVID, by the way.
Yeah.
So I was here less than a year and a half when COVID hit, And so we were 2 years into this weird kind of church and recording, you know, beginning by just recording and not even meeting, and then meeting outside and all of that. And so it's been 5 years, but in a way, you know, I feel like we're just now getting traction back because
yeah.
It took so long to come back from COVID and get people used to coming back to church again.
That's right. So let's get back to your life. And I got so many questions. I assume you were raised in a Christian family.
Well, not until Dad retired. We were never church people. I remember going to Bible school on the Army base. Well, not on the Army base, but, you know, buses would come through and they'd take us, you know, out. And we lived in Huntsville, Alabama at Redstone Arsenal, which is the Army base there. But I remember going to different Bible schools and things like that. But we weren't a church family. The whole time we were, you know, Dad was in the military, and when we came back, we moved back in August of 1976 so that all of us—I have three older brothers and one younger sister. My oldest brothers were twins. They were in—we moved back in August of 76 so they could start their senior year of high school back in West Virginia without having to, you know, split the year. So I came back to the eighth grade. My two oldest brothers were seniors, and the one next to him, it was a junior. And then my baby sister, she's 7 years behind me, so she was probably first, second grade. I can't remember. But when we moved back, we moved in with my Uncle Kermit.
You actually have an uncle named Kermit. Have an uncle named Kermit.
Uncle named Kermit. He was highly influential in our whole family because when we moved back to live with Uncle Kermit, he had three boys. One was a year younger than me. One was the same age as my oldest brothers, and one was already in college when we went back, but we all moved into his house. And so, I mean, it was a madhouse for a while. And but at Kermit's house, you went to church when the doors were open. And I used to tell people he had a key so he could open the door at any time because he worked in the church. He's a hard worker in the church. And that's so from the time I was 13, that's what we did. And we came back in August of 1976. And in or that it might have been 77 and Dad retired early 78. I think that's it. It was 77. October 23rd. 1977, we and my uncle went to the Church of God, Henning Church of God in Frankfort, West Virginia. On October 23rd, 1977, Dad was in from, you know, he took a weekend and came up to be with us. And on that weekend, on a Sunday night, October 23rd, 1977, every single one of us got saved at that altar.
The whole family?
The whole family, seven of us.
Were your cousins saved too?
Yes. Yeah. I mean,
okay. But did your uncle demand that your dad go to church when he
No, he just, it was dad wasn't there. Dad went back to Alabama to finish out his tour, you know, to retire. We came back early just so we could start the school year again without having to interrupt the school year. But it just became a natural thing. And I had a loving family, but we weren't a Christian family. And so when we moved in with Uncle Kermit and Aunt Thelma and the boys, it was just different for us. It was just they were close. They were huggy, I love you kind of stuff. And they were church people. And it just wore off, man. And they were just our witnesses. They were you know, they were good church folks, and they led us all to Christ. I mean, we owe a huge debt of gratitude. And
you sure but, do.
You know, when you're in military and you're not around family, you don't realize, you know, how all the habits of your family. So when we did come back, we realized that, especially on my dad's side, that the greater portion of them were church people. A lot of them were Church of God people. And so I was saved in the Church of God there in 1977. And then
how old were you?
I was 13.
13 years 13 old.
13 years old. My
sister. Okay, who in the family was the first to step out of the pew?
I don't remember because something else Kermit demanded was that we sing. We sang all the time. And so that was one thing. He said, if you're going to church, you're going to sing because we were all musicians. We were all singers. And so I specifically remember we were standing up front even before we were saved. Kermit's like, you're going to go up there and sing. And we were singing The King is Coming as a sort of a response song that night. I have no recollection of the sermon. No recollection of anything except standing up there singing and then realizing I need to go hit that altar. And I don't remember who went first. I don't remember who was last. All I remember is that we all went, and seven of us. And
Dad, Mom, the whole family.
Mom, dad, five kids. Yeah. And
wow, you're like the Philippian jailer. Didn't his whole family get baptized that night, I think?
I think so.
Like Cornelius?
I didn't know this would be a Bible quiz. I would have studied.
That's an amazing story.
It is a great story.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, people here, if you ask anybody that you know, and I know you got a lot of family here, if they've ever heard of Uncle Kermit, I promise you they'll say yes, because he's constantly coming up in my thoughts and in our whole family. Now, he passed away a few years ago. Aunt Thelma's still alive, but Kermit, he's gone on to be with the Lord. But
what a great man. I mean, to think, I mean, you're pastoring a church, touching lives, good old Uncle Kermit.
Yeah.
What a great story. So, wow, there's a lot I could ask you about that.
He was, when I accepted my call to ministry, I got a card from him, and I never knew this. He said, "I'm pretty sure God called me to ministry," and I resisted, and I never went. He said, "It just does my heart good that you're going."
Oh, that's, you know, that's great.
Because his grandfather was a minister, and Kermit always felt like God called him, but he never responded to that. Now, Kermit served. He was there's a book in one university that a cousin went to that's dedicated to the great country philosopher Kermit Hodge.
Wow.
He was a very smart man, just a great sense of humor, hardworking. He worked a full-time job and also farmed 40 acres, and that grew over the years. But he was just a huge influence on us. And
well, now you talk about singing the song before you went to the altar.
Yeah.
There is a Methodist church near here.
Mm-hmm.
That I was told by my Aunt Martha, who grew up around here, way, way, way back when, 1920s, 1930s, whatever. You know, the Methodists back in the old days, they would change pastors every 2 years.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so they had a new guy there, and they had the regular spring revival week and fall week. So the first time they had a revival, he decided, since nobody knew him, he would just be the evangelist. Mm. And midway through a sermon, he came under what we would call conviction.
Yeah.
And he stopped and he said, "I need to get right with God. I'm preaching to you." And he quit the sermon, went down to the altar, and got saved in the middle of his sermon.
I've heard those stories of deacon boards getting saved and that kind of thing.
Yeah. So what did you do? You felt the call to preach at 35 years old. So what trajectory did your life take from age 13 to age 35? What did you do for a living before?
I was a musician and I was a singer, and my assumption was, this is a good lesson too. We shouldn't assume where God's concerned. I'm a singer. I'm a Christian. I should be a Christian singer. So that's what I pursued. That's what I wanted to do from when I was young, and I went to school to do that. I went to Anderson College at the time, which is now Anderson University, for music business. And I was there when I decided just confession, I hated school when I was young. Turns out I know now that it's severely ADHD probably. And we know that because my son was just diagnosed, and the doc's like, this ain't a vacuum, you know, this doesn't just happen. But, so I went in the Army, and the year I went in the Army, it's interesting. Here's one of my other name dropping stories. Steve Chapman and I were in the same program in Anderson, and we left the same year. I went in the Army. He went to Nashville to go to Belmont University. When I came out of the Army after being gone for 4.5 years, three of that over in Germany, I was in a Bible bookstore one day, and I saw this tape by Stephen Curtis Chapman.
Oh, yeah.
And I looked at the picture. I'm like, that's not Stephen Curtis Chapman. That's Steve Chapman. I know that guy. Anyway. That got me, because I thought, man, I should have done something. Because here, you know, we were at the same point. Now, he was much further advanced. He had a group called Chapman Henderson there, and they were really good on campus and all that. And we were in the same program, some of the same classes. Not great friends. I knew his brother Herb a little more than I did him, but and Herb probably still wouldn't remember either. But that kind of hit me. I was like, man, you just wasted 4.5 years. You got to get back to getting in that music. And so it's just always this pursuit. So I did odd things. You know, I sold cars. I worked for a food company and all that, thinking that, you know, I'm going to keep working on music. I actually moved to Nashville in 94 thinking I got to get this out of my system. And that didn't last long. I was really didn't like the whole atmosphere there. But anyway, just did odd things and had a really good job when we had a revival at our church. I guess I'm trying to remember the year. I think it was 98 or something like that, 97. But out of that revival, I called my pastor a few days after that revival, and I said, his name was E.L. That's another name they hear around here a lot, E.L. Wheeler, one of the smartest men I've ever known. And I said, E.L., I think God's calling me to preach. And he busted out laughing. And in my mind, I'm thinking, this is not the reaction I was expecting from my pastor. And when he collected himself, he said, I'm sorry. He said, you don't understand. He said, you're the seventh guy from our church to call me and say, I think God's calling me to preach. There were nine by the end.
That's incredible.
Pastor's Sunday school class. E.L. taught it, and he would let us rotate through on Wednesday nights to preach. That's the first preaching experience we had. And then he would say, boys, I can't, there's nine of you. I can't give you my pulpit, on Sundays. He said, I'll let you rotate through on Wednesdays. He said, but I'll tell you, there's nursing homes all around here that would love to have preachers. And so we started this was in East Tennessee and in the 90s, and started a nursing home ministry, went to different nursing homes and rotated through that and preached. And he really taught us well and just helped us to understand what it meant to earn the right to be in a pulpit. And, because a lot of people want to be in the big pulpit before the big crowds, but not a lot of them. His point was, you've got to, if you're willing to preach the gospel, you'll preach it anywhere.
That's absolutely
true.
These
people need it. And so.
And that goes for singing too.
It does.
I've told people, I've learned you give it all you got if there's five people or 500 mm-hmm. or whatever. So what town in Tennessee would that have been in?
Well, we lived in Irwin, which is just south of Johnson City. We stumbled into this independent church, and I spent, 12, 15 years, I can't remember now, away from the Church of God in that. And that's where I felt my call to ministry and all that. And then came back to the Church of God when my sister went to one up in Princeton, West Virginia, and their youth pastor quit, and she knew that I'd just been ordained down there, and and she called me and said, our youth pastor just quit. You should come be the youth pastor. And this is the words that came out of my mouth, Lawrence, and this taught me a good lesson, too. I said, I would kill one of those kids because, I just thought, I don't have the patience for teenagers. And after we hung up the phone, the Holy Spirit got a hold of me and said, you're called. You let me worry about where. And, what's going to happen from here? Because I've got plans for you. Don't do that again. I mean, basically. And I called my sister back. I said, I feel like I was, I jumped a little bit there and shouldn't have said that. And I've been praying about it. And I think, maybe I would like to pursue this. And I did. And that was my first full-time ministry position. I was a youth pastor.
So
back in the Church of God.
Princeton, West Virginia.
Uh-huh.
And you were the lead pastor there too, right?
Well, at another church, 3 years later, I became the lead pastor of Landmark First Church of God, and I was there for 13 years.
Ebenezer, sell me. Now I'm standing at the crossroads. This one thing I ask, I long to return to lessons learned along the ancient path. Somebody ask, where are you going? Tell me, why are you walking so fast? I said, I've got to get back to the place of faith. It's the only thing that's ever gonna last. Last night I closed my eyes and saw a holy place. There was a stone on the ground. I could hear a sound coming from heavenly space. It said the stone rejected by the builders has become the cornerstone. And my soul cried, Ebenezer, thus far the Lord has helped me. Ebenezer, thus far the Lord has helped me. I run to my stone.
You showed me this paper with the history of this church. I had never seen a picture till today of the old church that burned down probably before I was born, or maybe around the year, I forget when it burned down, but it was where the cemetery is now. I had never seen a picture till today, but they built this, the first part of this present building. Do you know around what year? It was early 50s.
50s is all I've heard.
That church burned down, and I forget what the circumstances were. It was just a frame, unpainted building. And I don't know if you knew this about, you never knew my Aunt Martha. I think she died before you came, but she's the mother of Jeannie and Judy and Becky. My uncle owned a sawmill right up the road, and he had prepared wood to build their house. He was going to build a new house for my aunt. And my aunt was praying, and she went to my uncle, and she said, I want to give that wood to build the new church, because I want to take my kids to church, and I want them to come to know the Lord in church. So she gave up. They never built a house for her, but she gave it up to build the new building. And I thought that was a wonderful gesture on her part.
And to bring that story full circle, when COVID hit and we were out of church, my son was a host at a restaurant in Hartsville. He lost his job, so he was home. He and I began a project down in the fellowship hall to build a stage area, and we wanted it to be rustic, and we wanted it to connect to the community. And a lot of that wood on those rustic walls down there is from her house.
From
her house, yeah.
I know our time is limited, but you have done some things here since you came that nobody was able to pull off. I don't know how you did it.
It's out of pure ignorance, I promise you.
But tradition has been very strong here in the South, but in this community. And I remember one time there was a pastor here that wanted to remove that huge pulpit. There's a big, big pulpit that used to be in there.
Yeah.
And it had been there pretty well all my life. And, the people would have none of that.
Yeah.
We're going to keep that pulpit there. But now you come in here, you the pulpit's gone. You just started a welcome center. You've got a little coffee house area downstairs. And then of all things, I don't know how you did it, but you don't wear a tie.
I don't wear a tie. I don't tuck my shirt in either.
Yeah, yeah. I think I had a cousin that made you promise before you came. Will you please wear a suit for a funeral seat?
That was my compromise. I said, Miss Ann, I promise you I will wear a tie and a jacket for funerals and weddings. And and before I came here, she had told one of your other cousins that I will never preach to her without a suit and tie on. But we just came to this. I loved her, and I think she loved me.
Oh, she did love you. Yeah.
She just, you know, I loved her because you never had to worry about what she was thinking.
Yeah.
She never held a thought in. She let you know where she stood. But we had this great relationship, and I think it all worked out. But that I was very upfront when we were candidating here, which is another weird story how we wound up here. But when I was candidating here, I just said, look, I don't wear suits anymore. I don't do that. And I don't do, I don't do. In fact, I'm a worship leader too. And that was part of my candidating. And
yeah.
And the church had indicated they wanted to move on that front. So there was a little prep done before I got here, but, that's not to say it's all been smooth, but you know, I just think when you love people and yeah. I do love these people, I think there's a lot, you know, love covers a multitude of sins. Well, it buffers a multitude of change too when you love people.
And I have a cousin, Hain, who you knew very well. I think the first Sunday or two you were here.
It just, you said Hain, and it just like eight stories just popped into my head about him. And
well, it was time for church, and his wife, my cousin Jean.
That's my favorite.
Said Hain. What did she say?
Well, she walked through the house, and Hain was, had his shirt untucked, and he was just wearing some Dockers or khakis or whatever. And she said, Hain, it's time to go to church, get changed. And she walked on through. And she came back through in a few minutes. He's dressed the same way. I think she said he was dressed in his house clothes or something, she put it. And she said, Hain, it's almost time for church. Go get changed. And he said, look, said there's a new preacher and a new dress code. I'm going just like this. And I miss Hain so much because, and not just for this. I mean, he was always fun and loving and all that, but he just, you know, he said one time I was doing something with some Post-it notes, and this has been so long, I don't remember what I was doing, but, and he couldn't hear well, you know, of course, toward the end of his life, and you know, people can't hear well, they talk a little louder than they think they're talking. So in the service, somebody handed him some Post-it notes. He said, I don't know what this is about, but I'm all for it. You know, but it really is, you know, I just think it's the relationships that make the difference. And when you come in, and I think it's the longevity, you know, I think when you let people know, this is not a stepping stone.
Yeah.
This is a posting by God, and I'll be here as long as he allows it, as long as you allow it. I'm not looking to go anywhere.
Well, you're probably the most different pastor that I can ever think of being here. Just sort of join the 21st century. I don't know how to say it. Not that others didn't.
Yeah.
But can I say this? And we'll edit it out. But you even have a tattoo.
I do, and I've gotten it since I've been here.
And that would have been enough right there to.
Well, it's a, for lack of a better term, a Christian tattoo. My dad had one when I was a kid, and even my mom says, you know, when she's like, what is that on your arm? I said, Mom, blame it on your husband, because, you know, I'm fascinated from a young kid. And it took me over 50 years to do it, but
I'm dying to do it, but I'm scared I'd scream like a little girl.
I'll tell you, it hurts. I knew it was going to hurt, but when the guy started, I'm like, whoa, wait a minute, is that? No, he said, yeah, that's a bad place. It hurts, you know. So, it was a bucket list thing. Susan and I did it together. She got a little one on her wrist. And,
oh, my goodness, the pastor's wife got one, too.
It was during the COVID lockdown thing.
Oh, that would been scandalous in the 1950s.
Yeah, we were on vacation and we said we can't go in together, so whoever goes in first, don't say anything when you come out. And the first thing, Susan was first, and she come out, and Zoe and I were waiting on her, and she walked out the door going, "That really hurt." And I'm like, "You weren't supposed to say anything." But anyway, it's just this fun.
It's the Bible verse, thing. Isn't it? Is it yours, the Bible
verse? Yeah, it's John 3:30. It's my favorite Bible verse, not just because it's short, but it just is. He must become greater, and I must become less. And
what a great verse.
Yeah, I mean, and I've always said that has stuck with me for many, many, many years. And I can remember being a youth pastor and telling the youth, look, if you can live by this, if Jesus is always becoming more and more in your life and you are always becoming less and less, you're going to be okay. And that's just, you know, I've just been living with that in my brain for years and years. And I just thought, you know, that's where I'll start. I'm not sure I'll ever get another tattoo, but it's the one that's on me. So, but it's a great verse and it's a great concept. When Jesus comes to the center of the stage, I think this is how Eugene Peterson sort of paraphrased it, if you will. He said, now is the assigned time for Jesus to come to the center of the stage, me to step off to the side.
Oh, that's great. And I had a bunch of other questions, but that's a great way to end this interview.
Well, I appreciate it.
He become greater, I become less. I didn't tell the people what a great singer you are and a piano player.
I'm no Lawrence Tuning, but I'm.
God for that. Thank God for that. You can sing rings around Lawrence Tuning. Well, thanks for talking to me.
Sure, Lawrence. Thanks for coming by. I really enjoyed it.
Great.
Thanks for listening to our podcast tonight. And special thanks to Pastor Scott Hodge and his wonderful family who pastor the church where I came to know Jesus. We're only 2 weeks away from the concert that I'm going to be doing with my band Damascus Road, where we look at the life of Jesus. That's all we're going to do. We're going to look throughout the life of Jesus all the way up to the second coming. That concert is going to be on November 19th. That's a Sunday evening at 6 p.m. in Florence, South Carolina at Abundant Life Church. The address is 3030 South Irby. That's I-R-B-Y Street, Florence, South Carolina. I want to close this episode with a song that we are going to be performing at that concert. It's called Behold, He is Coming. Thanks for listening. God bless.
Even so, amen.
and my 88 friends. Me and my 88 friends. I will see.